Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all know the names of prominent Charlotteans who in many different ways have made significant contributions to our city. But before the Levines, the Belks, the Blumenthals, and the McCalls, there were others, many whose names and contributions to Charlotte's history have been lost to the mists of time. Scott Seifert was inspired to dig deeper into this forgotten and overlooked part of our history in 2010 after the unveiling of a bronze statue of Captain James Jack, the central figure in the legend of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. It appeared one day near CPCC, and many wondered why we'd put up a statue of Paul Revere galloping on horseback. We hadn't, but Captain Jack was the Paul Revere of the South. This all got Seifert into thinking about others who might be unknown to contemporary Charlotteans. The result of that thinking is a book by Scott Seifert, Eminent Charlotteans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City. By day, Seifert is a corporate attorney. And he's also co-founder of the May 20th Society, the organization dedicated to commemorating our supposed Independence Day here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. He's also on the board of the Trail of History, which you'll find along the Little Sugar Creek Greenway. Seifert delved into the mystery surrounding Captain Jack and the Mech Deck in his 2015 book, America's First Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. And he joined us in our Spirit Square studio the day after this year's Mech Deck Day. You are a native Charlottean, you're an attorney, but you studied history and political science at UNC Chapel Hill and the London School of Economics. What is it about history that fascinates you so?
I've always was passionate about history, but it was never local history. I think it was, you know, your normal 13-year-old boy who finds war interesting. So right. It was the Civil War or World War II. So those were sort of the topics that always interested me until about 15 years ago when I first heard this James Jack Mech Deck story that a friend told me at a bar. And I thought, this is unbelievable. This can't be true. I've never heard of this. And I'd grown up in Charlotte. But I had no memory or recollection or knowledge of any of the local history. And frankly, I found it kind of boring and passé. It just didn't excite me. But as we started this May 20th project to bring back the Mech Deck commemorations, I started learning more and more about this history, about the British occupying this area, the ride of Captain Jack, the Mech Deck story. And I thought, this is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And so from that came the first book I wrote about the Mech Deck story called The First Declaration of Independence, ? But there were so many other ancillary stories associated with that, which I didn't really get to, like the story of Joseph Graham, who fights the British here and is one of the Mech Deck witnesses, or the Catawba Indian chief, King Hagler, or others. So this sort of organically grew from that project of learning more about these sort of secondary stories.
You know, you think of other stories like other cities like Boston or Philadelphia or even Richmond, Virginia, which was the home of the Confederacy, and you know that they have history in them. But we do as well. I mean, if you walk up Tryon Street, there are these plaques in the pavement that talk about not only where Lord Cornwallis came through or where there was a skirmish at Trade and Tryon or further up the road, and the fact that the last meeting of the Confederate cabinet was held here in Charlotte, not too far from the square. Of course, we had the fort, I can't think of it, Camp Green, there it is.
Camp Green, right.
During World War I. So there's been a lot of history in Charlotte. How does our history, because you studied a lot of history, particularly while you were in London, British history. How does our history stack up against other cities' history?
Well, first of all, it's less tangible. If you go to Charleston or Baltimore or Philadelphia, you've got the old grand brick buildings. So if you visit, you can see it and get in it. I think when you grow up in a city like that, you're sort of surrounded by it. And Charlotte, of course, was a frontier log cabin town, and all the major structures, with one or two exceptions, are destroyed. They're lost in fires or just over the course of, you know, centuries go away. So there's nothing that you can really see that excites you about it. And so that's difficult to recreate that sense of history with Charlotte, which is why, you know, you have so many people, especially now, moving to Charlotte, and you see them in the breweries or on the rail trail or whatever, And they say, well, I love Charlotte. And they think the city's obviously 12 years old. So when you explain to them, going back 250 years, as you mentioned, Cornwallis is here and all these cool Revolutionary War era stories especially, they say, this is unbelievable. You know, how do we get a handle on that?
Yeah.
And there's no easy way to get a handle on that in this city.
Well, we're going to talk about your book, but you talked a minute ago about MECDEC Day, the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. And we do have a lot of newcomers here who, like you, have no clue what you're talking about. You didn't know anything about it originally. What is the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, and what is the significance of May 20th?
So that's a great question. It's the most important date on the Charlotte calendar, Mike, as you know. So MECDEC Day, May 20th, commemorates the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which per legend was the date on May 20th, 1775, when Mecklenburg County declared independence from Great Britain. And that date, May 20th, 1775, is commemorated on the North Carolina state flag to this day, the North Carolina state seal. You can see the First in Freedom license plates that came online a couple of years ago. So this used to be the biggest commemoration in Charlotte.
Now, that date is a full 14 months before July 4th, 1776.
That's exactly right.
So how did the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence precede the big one that we all know about, and who were the progenitors of it, if that's the right word?
That's a good word. So the brief story is, on May 19th, you have 26 militia leaders who are all Scots-Irish Presbyterians, and they're meeting in the log courthouse in the center of Trade and Tryon Street. And they receive word from an express rider that the Battle of Lexington and Concord has just occurred a month before. And they go ballistic. And over the course of 2 days, they debate a series of resolutions that become known in history as the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence.
How many people involved?
26.
26, okay.
26.
And how many people lived here at the time? 27?
20, 28. No, a couple hundred, I think it's fair to say. And so that becomes the MECDEC story. And it becomes a historical controversy because, as you know, the original papers are lost in a fire. So no one can definitively prove or disprove the story.
Well, I was going to ask you, is there any proof whatsoever? Because, I mean, it's a great legend, it's great lore, but and we have Captain Jack, who is the Paul Revere of the South, because he took the papers, Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence by horseback to Philadelphia to show the Continental Congress that we were ready to go.
That's right.
Had already voted to go. So is there anything anywhere, even if we've lost the original document, to say that people saw the document, that the Continental Congress read the document, were aware of the document, took a vote or didn't take a vote on the document, thought we were out of step with the mainstream, anything anywhere that anybody wrote or left behind?
What we have, and there's a lot of circumstantial and confusing and ambiguous evidence. The principal and all the papers are sort of torn in half or missing or undated. So there's no one piece of paper that everybody can look at and say, yeah, this is legit. Now, what you do have is the 17 eyewitnesses many, many years later who attest to the story. And there are people like Joseph Graham or Captain Jack or others. So they're credible witnesses. And they say, we were there on May 20th and this happened. And they give very lengthy accounts. Now, they give these 50 years after the fact. So the skeptics will say, you know, these folks are all confused, or they're misremembering the story, or they're glorifying the story more than really happened. So there is evidence. There is no evidence or proof that we can look to say Captain Jack made it, or he was there, or who he spoke with. That's all lost.
You're an attorney. Could you win this in a court of law?
Where's the court being held? Maybe.
Right. Okay.
Maybe.
So your book is called Eminent Charlatans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City. And you open the book with a definition of the word eminent from the Oxford English Dictionary, which says, when speaking of a person, it means famous and respected within a particular sphere. Why did you start with a definition?
Yeah, I almost had the definition and the title of the book in my brain before I sort of knew what I wanted to write about. There was a book called Eminent Victorians, which I read when I was in school in London 30 years ago. And it was sort of this model, which was a case study of various famous figures from the Victorian era. And it was a really good book, and it really stuck with me. And so when I started thinking about how does one tell the story of famous people in Charlotte, that model just recurred in my brain. Why not eminent charlatans? That's the people that are famous in Charlotte. Not famous, because they're not really famous. They're more obscure, but they're very important. I mean, so none of the people, as you allude to in the book, are sort of household names. other than arguably maybe Captain Jack, because of the OMB beer and sort of the fame that, you know, he's come to in the last 10 years. But there are people that built the community, are very important, and are well-known in historical society, but not well-known generally speaking.
So you write about your a time in London and as a student, and you frequent a bookstore in Charing Cross Road. There's a play about a bookstore in Charing Cross Road. Oh, yeah. It's a very good one, too. And I think they made it into a movie. But anyway, you read a lot of English histories while you were over there and going to that same bookstore, and you decided that Charlotte would benefit from a similar telling of its own history. So is this book based in style on that book you mentioned, Victorians?
I wouldn't say style, more as just structure. Just structure in the sense of it's 12 profiles that are picked more or less randomly by me.
And you say in the book that most of our local history is and remains buried, torn down, forgotten, and unkept. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, there's a couple reasons. There's many, many reasons. The first is, as I mentioned, you know, we don't have a lot of structures that people can point to. So that's just a fact of life, that we have to recreate a lot of this.
Because we didn't have stone buildings.
Correct. We had very few. That's right.
A lot of log and wooden structures that just rotted away with time.
Yeah, that's right. Torn down
because they were just little shacks and let's move on.
Right, right. Yeah. And the city deliberately, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s especially, said we're going to be a new South City.
Right.
You know, we're getting past all the historical baggage in the last 200 years. We're going to look forward. So there wasn't an emphasis on keeping any of this history alive or even necessarily celebrating it that much. Mm-hmm. We were going to look forward, not backwards.
What do we gain by celebrating it? Particularly, what do we gain by looking at these eminent charlatans, some of whom, and I salute you for this, are unusual to be included in a history book told from the point of view of a Eurocentric person such as yourself.
Right, right. Well, I think what we gain is, like as with any history, the knowledge of who we are and where we came from, without which we have no real idea, do we? And, you know, it's really been interesting as a lot of people from outside of Charlotte have moved into the city. That has really resurrected an interest in local history, sort of counterintuitively.
Because they want to know where they are.
Yeah, yeah. And what's the authentic story of this place? Because you can't see it walking down the street. You can't say, oh, there's Faneuil Hall. That's interesting. You have to say, someone tell me the story because I can't learn it on my own.
So you wrote about 12 people throughout the entire history of Charlotte. A lot of people have lived here in the entire history of Charlotte. Right. How did you come to choose those 12? Why did you narrow it down to simply 12?
That's a great question. So the other sort of focus of the project started with the Trail of History, of which I'm on the board. And that erects the bronze.
And what is that? Because a lot of people don't know what that is.
Right. So the Trail of History was a project started by Dr. Tony Zeiss, president of CPCC, about 10 years ago, to erect bronze statues of historical eminent charlatans on the Little Sugar Creek Greenway. And the first of which, 8 years ago yesterday, that was unveiled was Captain Jack. And since then, four others have been unveiled. So there's five bronze statues to people such as Thaddeus Lincoln Tate, who's in the book, William Henry Belk, who's not. And others, and there's five more statues currently in the queue to be unveiled. So, and part of that selection process is we have a historical committee who looks through Charlotte history and polls local historians, and we select people that we think are appropriate to be commemorated on the trail. And Thaddeus Lincoln Tate's a great example as a chapter in the book on him, but I knew nothing about him, and I think I would venture most people would not.
Well, by the time this show is over, people will know about Thaddeus Lincoln Tate. They will know about King Hagler, who we'll talk about when we come back in a moment. They will certainly know about the two Thomases in your book, Thomas Spratt and Thomas Polk, and several others as we go through this hour with Scott Seifert, author of Eminent Charlatans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City. We're going to take a break. Going to come right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scott Seifert is with us, a local attorney, co-founder of the May 20th Society, author of Eminent Charlatans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City and a member of the Trail of History Board, where you help select who, what historical figures should be on that trail. But some of the people on that trail are not in the book. Some of the people in the book are not on the trail. So having your fingers in both pies and making decisions about both things, how did you come up with, how do you make these decisions?
Well, you know, they're tough decisions, and we find that in the Trail of History. If you did as a thought experiment, said, can you pick 25 people from Charlotte that are not living, so they're historical,
right,
or not current, how would you come up with that list? And how would you make it representative of demography, of time, of time periods, of race and gender and class and sort of things like this? So that's something we struggle with on the Trail of History Board, to be fair and balanced, so to speak, and find these individuals. But it's very, very challenging, especially a lot of these people who warrant recognition, such as Thaddeus Lincoln Tate, are no longer really well known. Mm-hmm. So we find a lot of individuals who have great stories and are untold stories in Charlotte. But you simply, there's no momentum to really do much for them. So part of the book, the focus of the book, was to tell the story of Thaddeus Lincoln Tate. If you're walking on the Trail of History behind the Metropolitan along the creek there, there's a statue of Thaddeus Lincoln Tate by Ed Dwight. It's a very nice statue. But if you said, well, who is this guy? How do I learn more about him? There was really no place to go to. And similar with Captain Jack and a lot of these characters. So I started with the people that had been selected by the Trail of History for statues, but there were other stories that were interesting, like Joseph Graham and the Battle of Charlotte, I found interesting. So even though he's not on the Trail of History, I thought he should be in the book.
You stopped the book with some people from the Greatest Generation, which is the World War II generation, but you spent a lot of time, and you admit to this, you spent a lot of time in the Revolutionary War period and say that it's overrepresented in your book.
That's
Why?
True. Well, I mean, that's just such an interesting part of Charlotte's history because one could make the argument that the most interesting historical things that happened here happened in that 15-year period around 1775. Mm-hmm. You've got the founding of the community. You've got the MacDeck store. You have the British. You have the battle on Tryon Street right outside here. So there's a lot of parts of that that are really interesting and cool. You've got the Captain Jack ride. So admittedly, as I say, it is somewhat over-representative from a sort of historical perspective, but they're all good stories. So that really was the driving focus of how I picked individuals.
You also start the book pre-Revolutionary War with a figure that I had never heard of before. King Hagler, spelled H-A-I-G-L-E-R, although that may not be how he spelled it, and it's of German derivation, in a Scots-Irish part of the country, taken on by a Catawba Indian leader. You put a picture, in fact, of a Native American on the cover
Hagler. That is Hagler.
Which is unusual for American history to include a really deep profile of an Indian leader, a Native American leader, and to put him on the cover. Why did you put him on the cover?
Well, he's just such an interesting story. And the Catawba, of course, were the first settlers here.
Right.
So you can't tell the story of Mecklenburg County without telling the original settlers here for thousands of years before the white Europeans arrived.
Right.
We had many Indian tribes, as you know, in this area, the Esaus, not the Cherokee, but the Sugar, from which we get Sugar Creek Presbyterian or Sugar Creek, and the Catawba, being the largest tribe south of town, had a lot of interaction with the settlers. So they were an important part of the story of founding of Mecklenburg County.
So 1749, I think King George is the second, or is that a typo?
No, I think it's the second.
Okay, King George II was on the throne. This is not the bad guy
There's no typos in there.
Oh, yes, there are. We should catch up sometime. But King George II preceded King George III. He's the guy we fought in the
That's
Revolution.
Right.
And King Hagler is on the throne. Well, maybe not. Let me go back here. They had recently selected him as their new leader.
Correct.
His real name is Napkihi.
That correct? That's correct.
He often called himself the Prince of Wales.
That's right.
How did he even know about the Prince of Wales?
Well, there was a lot of interaction, of course, between the Catawba and the settlers here. They traded goods. So it was a very organic relationship that was not, you know, there's this image of sort of these Indians maybe living in the woods and the Europeans are living here. That's not the case. There was major interaction, of course, like Thomas Spratt, who's a character in the book,
right,
adopts a Catawba child. Many of the settlers intermarry with Catawba people. So they had a very interrelationship between the two peoples.
Hmm. You say he was probably born around 1700, and, quote, it is possible and interesting to speculate that Hegler was briefly educated in Virginia in a European school at Fort Christana. We don't know for certain.
We don't know. There's a lot we don't know for certain about this whole period.
But he spoke English, right?
But he spoke English,
and many of these Catawbas spoke and wrote and read English.
That's correct.
If they didn't go to that school, how would they have learned that? From the settlers?
Just from the settlers. And you pick it up because you had to. You'd come into town and you're trading, right? You'd come into the county courthouse on the Sundays and you'd trade for goods, or settlers would pass through buying your wares.
How did the Catawbas take to these European settlers moving into their territory?
Well, as you might imagine, the relationship was sort of up and down, and there were periods of periods of conflict and stress, and there were periods where they generally got along. And the Hegler story is interesting because he is surrounded on all sides by disease, European settlement, smallpox, alcohol, which was a major scourge of the Catawba. And his goal is to keep the tribe alive, which he does, which is not the case of a lot of these other tribes that we mentioned.
Why the name Hegler? It's a German name. It's a Scot-Irish part of the world, at least if you're not a Native American.
Right.
And you're here, you're Scots-Irish.
Right.
So why did he take a German name?
No idea. Well, you know, and the thing is, if you read in the colonial records, it's Hagler, it's H-A-G-L-A-R, it's H-G-L-R.
Was he a Hagler, perhaps?
He could have been an Hagler, that's right.
Like a tough guy to bargain with, maybe?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, that could be.
All right.
We don't know, is the honest answer.
The fact that he could have or might have, and in fact some Native Americans were sent to this school in Virginia to educate them, sounds like a very nice, progressive thing, but you say it wasn't. They were essentially held hostage.
Yeah, this was at the end of a conflict period with the Catawba, and as part of this settlement, so to speak, the Europeans would kindly take a lot of the Catawba children away of the major leaders and educate them in a school, which is a different way of saying they were hostages until the situation calmed down.
I see.
It's very common.
But the Catawba Indians evidently adopted a European lifestyle, is that right? I mean, they spoke English, they had unique friendships among the settlers. They obviously got involved in alcohol, which King Hagler tried to stop, saying that his people couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Let the English or the Scots-Irish people get drunk amongst themselves and have a good time. Leave us alone.
Leave us alone, exactly.
And you write that he came to power after a period of difficulties between the settlers and the Creek and Cherokee tribes, and they all got together in Charlestown, which is today Charleston. But as you point out, so often happens that when Native Americans went among the settlers in their towns, they got really sick.
Yeah.
Because they had no immunity to European-born diseases like smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened here when they all met in Charlestown.
Yeah.
A lot of them died, including the leader of the Catawbas, which is how King Hagler came to power, because he wasn't there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fascinating story, but so Charlestown's the largest settlement in the Carolinas, obviously. So when the governor of South Carolina has to convene a peace conference, he wants everybody to come to South Carolina. Well, South Carolina's on the coast. It's got mosquitoes and waterborne diseases. It's very unclean. So the Indians hated going to Charleston. They were very fearful of it. And they would resist and resist. And at this meeting, as you allude to, the various leaders of tribes came to Charleston at his request and quickly began to die.
Yeah.
And so all the major Catawba headmen are wiped out. And Hagler, who's not there, is made chief of the Catawba.
How did they get to Charleston from here? Did they walk?
You walked.
That'll kill you right there.
That's, in the summer.
So... Once Hegler came to power, what was his major contribution? Why is he in your book?
Well, he is. His major contribution is he works with the local settlers. He's friends with Thomas Spratt and others, and he very proactively makes a decision that he is not going to be adversarial to the European settlers because he sees that that is a long-term losing proposition, which indeed it was for most of other tribes. So he chooses a very canny diplomacy that keeps his people alive.
So let's talk about John Spratt, who he made a friendship with. And John Spratt later, as you said, went on to adopt a Catawba child who, and allowed that child to be buried in the family cemetery, which is down near Fort Mill. John Spratt, the Spratts are still, John Spratt, it was a congressman recently, a congressman from South Carolina. So the Spratts are still part of the area. Thomas Spratt is thought to have been the first European settler to cross the Yadkin River in a wheeled cart. Therefore, among the very first settlers in what would become Mecklenburg County. Who was Thomas? What did he do in his time?
So Thomas Spratt was a sort of an embodiment of the Scotch-Irish Presbyterian settler who settled Mecklenburg County. And he comes in the first half of the 18th century down the Great Wagon Road, it's called, from Philadelphia, here into the backcountry, where there's very few people, where land is essentially free because no one knows who owns the land. And you can settle, and no one can really stop you. You can be left alone.
And one of the reasons they came, first of all, to America was because they were escaping the oppression of the Anglican Church, because they were Presbyterians. And also they wanted to escape the settlements up north that were fundamentally England all over again.
That's right.
So they came to the backwoods because no one wanted to come here.
That's right.
And there was freedom and no taxes.
Freedom, no taxes, no Anglican Church. That's right.
That's why they were here.
So
you write that the Scots-Irish, who were predominantly Presbyterian, fled the Anglicans and the British, and they eventually moved south, and they were particularly drawn to the Carolinas, and that the British were happy to have them settle in the backcountry away from the coast and the main settlements to act as a buffer between what?
The French in the north and the Indians, the hostile Indian tribes all around. Well, the English in the cities were happy to get rid of them because they didn't like the Scotch-Irish in the first place. They didn't like them in Europe, and then they start showing up here by the thousands. So the English were happy to move them along. And the farther they could move them into the backcountry, where they could be a bridge against the Cherokee or other hostile Indian tribes, or against the French, remember, who controlled a large part of the Ohio and other parts of the Northwest, they were happy to get rid of them. They'd be a useful sort of foil.
If you think some people's comments about immigrants today are mean, here's what one Anglican minister had to say about the Scots-Irish. He referred to them as, quote, "certainly the worst vermin on earth, ignorant men, worthless, beggarly Irish Presbyterians, the scum of the earth, and the refuse of mankind." How did the Native Americans feel about him?
He didn't tweet that, by the way. that's representative of what a lot of the – that's a minister, as you point out.
Exactly right.
This is how the English felt about the Irish, and the Irish felt the same way about the English. They did not care for these folks.
The English also called them crackers.
They did call them crackers.
Is that where that term comes from?
It is. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
Yeah.
So did the Indians take to them? Did the Native Americans take to them? Evidently, these were rough and tumble people, not terribly refined.
No, they were not terribly refined. They were tough people. They were not the most well-mannered people. But, of course, so yes, they got along with Catawba quite well. And they just, again, they wanted to be left alone. So they lived here. They made their homes in the woods. They had some negative and some positive interactions with Catawba, generally speaking. And as I said, Thomas Spratt and King Hagler personally were very good friends, which is on the Trail of History. If you're up in front of the Van Avery Culinary Arts Building at CPCC, there's a dual statue of Spratt and Hagler standing there together.
Okay.
Because they were sort of the foundation of the community, the Indians on one side and Spratt as the Europeans on the other.
But you refer to another Thomas, Thomas Polk, as the founding father of this area.
That's right.
Why?
So Polk is, Spratt is the first one here. And that's why he's well known. And then Thomas Polk is a sort of generation after. And Thomas Polk is the man who put Charlotte on the map, literally. He is a local politician, business leader, militia leader. And Charlotte is where it is because he decides that the county courthouse is going in the middle of Tryon Street in front of his home.
And why did he make that decision? Who made him God?
Well, I'm not sure anybody made it. He's a politician, right?
Okay.
So when he got to decide where to put the convention center, He put it in his front yard. No, he was very canny real estate.
He's responsible for where the NASCAR Hall of Fame is.
Not directly, but.
No, seriously, why did he have the power to decide that the courthouse was going to be right down the street?
So he's one of the leading political folks here. He's a member of the House of Commons.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
In Britain?
No, here. It's later the representatives, but from the British period, it's called the House of Commons.
So what year is this?
This is sort of 1750s.
How many people were here then?
Probably 100? In Mecklenburg County, you had a couple thousand in the county. Which is larger than it is now.
All right.
And Polk is one of the leading guys, so that's why. So people look to him for advice and support. And he's got a lot of political clout.
Is he an ancestor of President James K. Polk?
He is. He's the great uncle of James K. Polk. Okay. Of course, a lot of Polks still here, directly related to those folks.
So he put his house on Tryon Street, on the corner of, near the corner of what would be Trade and Tryon?
Correct.
So his house, I think it was on the northeast corner?
That's right, where Bank of America currently is.
So that's a famous place. Is there anything on the street that would tell you in that area that that's where his house was?
So there's a plaque in the ground. Yes, there is a plaque in the ground that says Thomas Polk lived here. You know, it's interesting. We talk about tearing down these old buildings. So until about the 1920s, I believe, maybe a little earlier, Thomas Polk's house was the tourist attraction in Charlotte.
So it was still here in the 1920s?
Was. After
they
the turn of the
century.
They tore
it down?
Yes.
They tore it down?
Tore it down. But it was the place
Why?
You came to see, and it said Cornwallis slept here, and it was this old...
Why would you tear that down?
I know. It's sad, isn't it? It's an old dilapidated building, and they didn't
And it was in the middle of town, and they wanted to put a belk there.
Yeah. But that's where... That's right.
Because that's where it was.
That's right. That was the place you went and saw.
I'll be darned.
Wouldn't that be interesting if it's still here?
Are there any photographs of it that exist?
There are.
Really?
Yeah.
That's astounding to me. Dan Morrill once said, we do not tear our history down. Oh, Dan? Yes, we do.
We don't anymore.
Okay, we don't anymore. So he was also, Thomas Polk also played a role, you say, in the infamous Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence.
He did.
What role was that?
So Thomas Polk is the guy who calls the meeting at which the 26 militia officers are present. And then he is, by legend, the individual who reads the Mec Dec from the stairs of the county courthouse at noon on May 20th, 1775.
Oye, oye.
That's right.
And he reads the thing.
That's right. And he reads
delivers
it. The,
he's the first newscaster in Charlotte.
That's right. He's the Mike Collins of his day.
Now, he was on television. People saw him. And then Captain Jack allegedly is the man who took it via horseback in a satchel, one presumes, all the way to Philadelphia. Was that a dangerous journey? Beyond the fact that it was barren wasteland from here
right. Well, yes, it was. If you think about it, I mean, he's carrying resolves with him against the British crown, and so if he's caught by loyalists who are guarding the roads for by British soldiers in Philadelphia, something like that, he would have been hanged for treason, obviously, because they are a year before, as you point out, a year before the National Declaration of Independence.
So, how did he slip? I only have 20 seconds. How did he slip it past those guards?
We don't really know that part.
It's on microfilm.
It could have been. Could have been.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back, talk more about other things that you don't find in other history books that you will find in this History of Charlotte called Eminent Charlatans by our guest, Scott Seifert at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about prominent figures, eminent figures throughout Charlotte's history, which were uncovered and written about by our guest today, Scott Seifert, a local attorney, but he's also the co-founder of the May 20th Society, which is the organization that promotes knowledge about Mec Dec Day, the day that Mecklenburg's Declaration of Independence was signed on May 20th, 1775. 14 months before the big one was signed in Philadelphia by Congress assembled. His book is called Eminent Charlatans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City. As I mentioned, your book has a picture of King Hegler, the Catawba Indian chief, on the cover, which is unusual for an American history book. You also go into a great detail about the slaves, because they are left out of a lot of history books, or they're only peripherally mentioned. And this is kind of a welcome departure, the contributions of slaves. And among them, you include, among the group of eminent charlatans, a man named Ishmael Titus. We meet him at the age of 89 in a Massachusetts courtroom. He was a slave from Rowan County, sent by his master to fight against the British. What's the story there?
So Ishmael Titus is a fascinating story. He was a slave, as you say, from Rowan County, and his master is drafted into the local militia. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you can get out of that is you send a replacement for your service, which was a common thing to do. And a lot of the wealthy white slave owners would send a slave to serve for them. And they would tell them sometimes that if you do this, you know, I'll free you after your term of service is up. So Ishmael Titus is one of those stories. And he goes and fights with the Americans, you know, all over the South. He's at the Battle of Kings Mountain, at Guilford Courthouse, at some very, very major engagements. And he says at one point that he felt after the war that he'd walked all over the Carolinas, which he probably had.
Probably did.
He'd passed through Charlotte, retreating with the Americans in August of 1780 after they flee the Battle of Camden, before the British invade a month later. And so he's a fascinating story. But after the war, his master reneges on the promise to free him. And
how do we know that?
We only know this from sort of secondhand stories that he tells later in life. And so he makes his way up to Massachusetts, where he lives to the ripe old age of, I think, 92.
Is this post-Civil War when he gets to Massachusetts, or is it
before
Civil War?
Before Civil War.
How did he get there? Did he flee? Did he escape? Did he simply not go back to the...
It's all speculation, but the thinking is that he escaped and fled north and moves, because he moves several times throughout mm-hmm. New York and up to Massachusetts.
And you write that in that courtroom, he was asked to prove his involvement as a soldier in the Revolutionary War, and he's 89.
Right.
And he can't remember all the great details, but he knew peripherally where he was and what he did and who led the battles, etc. Is there any question in your mind that he actually did participate in the war?
Not in my mind. No.
Was there any question in the minds of the people in that courtroom at the conclusion of, was it a trial?
Yeah, it's a pension hearing.
Okay, so because everybody got a pension if they fought in the Revolution.
If you fought in the Revolution by act of Congress about 1830, if you applied, you could get a federal pension. But to apply, you had to have, you did your own testimony that you'd have to go into court and say, I was here, I was there, mm-hmm. and you'd have to have witnesses, right, which is very difficult.
Did he have them?
Because he could not, of course, he could not produce them because he's fled to the north. So all the people he associated with are back here.
Did he get his pension?
He did not get his pension. In fact, there's an ongoing lawsuit by his descendants mm-hmm. to get his pension.
Even today?
Today.
Really?
Yeah.
How much was the pension?
A couple thousand dollars.
Of course, with interest.
Yeah.
We can't afford to pay that pension anymore.
It's going to be expensive. So there's a plaque to Ishmael Titus on the Charlotte Liberty Walk in front of the Gantt Center.
This is something else I'll bet you a lot of people don't know. There were 450,000 slaves in all 13 colonies at the start of the Revolution. We were not a big slaveholding state. When you compare us to South Carolina and Virginia, how many slaves lived in this area? Do we know?
We guess, but there was quite a number. By 1860, it's basically 40% of the population. So at first, when it's, when the Scotch-Irish are coming down here, these are very poor people. So most folks did not have a lot of slaves just because they were poor themselves. And as time goes, and Thomas Polk and others, these families get richer, that increases. So by 1860, 40% of the population, as I say, is African-American slaves.
And about 5,000 of those slaves fought against the British in the Revolution.
Right.
Some were slaves, some were free men fighting against the British. Did any of them fight for the British?
Quite a number fought for the British. It's a really fascinating story I didn't know anything about, because you sort of have this image of the American Revolution. It's the red coats versus the blue coats, you know, in a field in somewhere in Massachusetts. And there's all these sub-stories about the American campaigns here, but also about the slaves who fought for and against the Americans.
Now, the British owned slaves, too, up until, I think, Queen Victoria. Were they promised anything either by the British when they fought for the British or by the colonists? If they fought for the colonists, were they promised freedom? Were they promised money?
Right.
Or did they just think, this is part of life, and I'll go back to the plantation when it's over?
So the British royal governor Lord Dunmore, issues a proclamation during the Revolutionary War that says, if you come into the British lines and you fight for us, we will grant you freedom. And this is, as you might imagine, extremely controversial and extremely mm-hmm. hated in the South, because it is seen as an incitement to slave rebellions. Mm-hmm. But so thousands of slaves would defect. Everywhere the British move, it was said, slaves would follow them because they wanted to be free.
When I watch movies about this time period or read books about this time period, I often think to myself, you wouldn't have made it 5 minutes in this time period. You'd be dead, or you'd want to be dead, because life was brutal.
It was tough.
It was harsh. And that was for everybody, including the Scots-Irish. But according to your book, it was particularly so for slaves.
For sure.
How so?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the worst of the worst, right? Can you imagine being a slave working on a plantation in the Carolinas in the 1830s, 1840s? I mean, it would just been, you know, the absolute worst experience imaginable.
Ill-housed, ill-clothed, ill-fed. In fact, the British wrote, and you write about this, I think it was the British, saying that they often saw children walking around naked.
That's right.
And even some adults with only a shirt on, and the shirt was open.
Yeah.
So they were not, because people didn't have clothes. Even the settlers didn't have clothes.
Right.
So why should the slaves get them?
It's almost, we can't even imagine it really these days, to be honest with you. But yeah, the accounts of that period of the people living through this are really remarkable.
Now, we know very little about the lives of slaves. And we know very little about the individual slaves, except for a few that you've mentioned in this book. But if you go to Huntersville, there is a slave burial ground with a stone marker. And there's a photograph of this in your book. And it mentions, the marker mentions Uncle Jim and his wife, Lizzie, and Uncle Charles and his family. They were slaves?
Mm-hmm.
Why were they so honored and so remembered?
Well, in their case, you know, they had a very good relationship with their with the people that owned them, with the families. So the family, you know, they're considered part of the family. So when they passed away, the remaining family members erected that stone to it, which was not unusual.
In fact, one of the, I don't know whether this is the same family, but one of the slave owners that you write about prohibited the selling off or the splitting apart of his slave families after his death at risk of being disinherited.
That's right.
So he had a soft spot in his heart for these people?
You know, it's difficult to sort of get in the, it's almost impossible, frankly, to get in the mentality of what people were thinking back then. So all we know are the facts, right? We know the facts that there's slave cemeteries, but there are these families that apparently had very good relations, but were very well thought of. And we had slaves that lived with the families even after they were freed. So the sort of interpersonal relationships and dynamics are very hard to sort of get your head around these days.
At the very beginning of our conversation, you mentioned a man named Thaddeus Lincoln Tate. Who was he?
So Thaddeus Lincoln Tate is commemorated on the Trail of History, as I mentioned, with a bronze statue. And he's one of these individuals we discovered as part of our project who is still very well known in the African-American community, is less so in sort of Charlotte broadly, which we're going to try to change. But he was, his parents were slaves. He moved to Charlotte about 1870. So the post-Civil War, Charlotte, antebellum South, Great Depression here, very difficult place to live. And he builds a business. He builds a barbershop.
And he was born 172 days after General Lee surrendered at Appomattox.
Right.
So he was born post-Civil War.
At the very, towards the very end of the Civil War.
So he starts a barbershop.
He starts a barbershop in the Central Hotel.
Where was that?
Which is located on the southeast corner of Trade and Tryon Street. It was kind of the place to
stay. So it's where NCNB started.
That's right.
And where the strange Pomodoro obelisk.
Big disc is there, yes.
Big disc is there.
That's right.
So that's where that hotel was.
That's right.
And it was a big hotel.
It was a big hotel,
yeah.
It was the center of town. This is the place everybody who's anybody showed up as sort of the Ritz-Carlton of its day, I guess.
Right.
But this is where you went, or the Kempton. This is where you went, and he had the barbershop, which was the sort of center of social activity.
And weren't there two barbershops in there for a while, and they combined forces?
That's right.
As a result? And if I read your book correctly, you had to be African-American to be a barber.
Yes, it wasn't, in a sense, segregated like that, but that was a profession for African-Americans, almost exclusively.
Interesting. He was the leading stylist and barber to the white community.
That's right.
At one point. What made him so wonderful? Why do people like him so much?
Well, I think he was just a nice guy. He was just a nice guy with a good heart. And so he is known to everybody in town. And he's celebrated by the local media and by state media. And he's a simple barber running a barbershop.
You'll quote some articles. I think it's in the Charlotte Observer or whatever preceded the Charlotte Observer. And they write about him in glowing terms.
Yeah.
I don't think you would ever see that in a newspaper today, any kind of a publication. It was glowing.
Yeah.
They loved this guy.
They loved him. They loved him.
Yeah. He came to be, however, far more than a barber. He uh, He became a real estate tycoon, and he was in what you call the vanguard of a generation that embraced philanthropy within the black community.
That's right. So he, you know, he's an interesting and well-liked individual, but why he's important is he was the founding African-American individual for philanthropy in Charlotte community. So he establishes AME Zion Church. Mm-hmm. He establishes the first library for African-Americans only. He is responsible for the first black police officers and so forth. So he does all this thing to advance his community, and that's why he's remembered fondly and well-loved.
Does he have descendants here?
He does, yeah.
Okay. Did you get a chance to talk to any of them?
I did not personally, but yeah, when we did the commemoration, and this has happened for Ishmael Titus's plaque, for yes, we had dozens of descendants.
Wow.
Which is really cool.
Let's talk about a woman, because this is another historical figure in this book, and women are underrepresented in history books, not in this one necessarily, but her name, her last name is Alexander.
That's
a very
right.
prominent name in this town, but I'm not sure that anybody knows who Annie Lowry Alexander mm-hmm. was or why she deserves to be in your book. Why should we know her?
So Annie Alexander comes from the fabled Alexander clan that mm-hmm. plays a big role in the MacDeck and other Revolutionary War stories. But she comes at a time where women weren't doctors. You didn't enter the medical profession. It wasn't done. And she becomes the first licensed doctor in North Carolina. And she practices medicine here on Tryon Street, just down the street from you.
Her father was a doctor, and mm-hmm. her father encouraged her to become one because he lost a patient who was afraid to be examined by a male doctor. Mm-hmm. So he thought, well, we need female doctors.
That's right.
And she becomes one. How difficult? Because what year was this? Late 1800s?
Yeah.
How difficult was it for her to establish a practice, gain the trust of people at a time when there were no female doctors?
Yeah, and in Charlotte, which was somewhat of a backwater then. It's not like she was in New York or a more progressive area, but it was extremely difficult. So she really was the forerunner breaking the glass ceiling. And it didn't happen that you had female doctors. It just wasn't thought of. So she was extremely courageous. And again, well-liked. She was considered a bit of an oddity in Charlotte. You know, in the 1920s, she had her own car.
Yeah.
So she drove herself around, and she traveled around the country. She went to the Grand Canyon and all these places, you know, by herself. That just isn't the way that women behaved in that period.
Right. Well, she went to the Grand Canyon. There was a picture of her evidently taken touring the Grand Canyon in bloomers, and people thought, well, that was indecent.
That's right.
but she was a single woman. She was a rebel. She had liberal political views, and yet she had a practice. People came to her anyway. Is this scandalous, this woman?
Scandalous, that's right.
she did, however, lead public health campaigns, which is groundbreaking, I would think, for a man or a woman in that day. But she called for compulsory medical inspection of school children and rural public health nursing. Was she able to make that happen?
She was quite successful in a lot of her medical campaigns, and she's extremely well known in the period up to her death. You know, so it was the largest public funeral in Charlotte when she died.
Really?
Yes, thousands of people attended.
She died in 1929. Were you able to speak? People are still alive.
Yeah.
Were you able to talk to anybody who actually knew her?
So not anybody who knows her or knew her. But the North Carolina State Historical Marker folks put a marker up to her old law office on South Tryon Street, at which one I was either a grandson or great-grandson was present.
Of the people that we've talked about, or the ones that we haven't talked about in your book, who stands out to you as being the most interesting or the most historically significant?
Well, I have a bias, so as you know, and the interesting ones, you know, the Revolutionary War period to me is just very interesting in that, so Captain Jack and Joseph Graham, all those stories are really, but I found all of them interesting, and I didn't know any of them. So for me, this was just a voyage of discovery.
So how did you find out about them? How did you do your research?
So you just start researching. You start doing internet search, or you go to the library here, downtown library, and there's a lot of people with a lot of passion for these individuals, especially who work in the library, who know a lot about them, the world's leading experts. So all you have to do is ask, and then information starts coming in, and you start building a profile.
We've only scratched the surface of the dozen historical figures fleshed out in Scott Seifert's book, Eminent Charlatteans, 12 Historical Profiles from North Carolina's Queen City, which was published back in March. You can find statues of some of the people who shaped Charlotte's history and who were profiled in the book along the Trail of History on the Little Sugar Creek Greenway. There's a link with more information about the trail on the Charlotte Talks page at WFAE.org. Seifert is also the author of the 2015 book, America's First Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. For more information on the May 20th Society, of which Scott Seifert is co-founder, head to maytwentiethsociety.org. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.